The Adventures of Indiana Jim, special edition number 8 for April 15th, 2010.
And now, coming to you not exactly live from
the Cliffs of Insanity,
a man who needs no introduction.
Don't tell me you've never heard of me.
That international man of geekery.
I have entertained in all the courts of Europe and speak a ready wit in their every tongue.
That intrepid arch geekologist.
Hard to believe, isn't it?
I remember first hearing your name when I was up at Oxford.
I told you I was famous.
Indiana Jim!
Well, I never be.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Adventures of Indiana Jim, special edition number 8, wherein you will hear my interview with author David J. Williams. He is the author of the Autumn Rain trilogy, the novels being The Mirrored Heavens, The Burning Skies, and The Machinery of Light. A very, very interesting interview. And, you know, I typically don't go for the hard sci-fi, but for hard sci-fi, this really works for me, and I think the discussion with the author himself is a little more, we're a little more engaged in the science angle of, you know, the worldview of this particular trilogy. And if you'd like to learn more about the author and the work, you can visit his fantastic website at autumnrain2110.com. There you will find what essentially would be your appendices on the website. And I think it's a really good use of the web space because a lot of times it's just the author bio and maybe a calendar of events and maybe links to your books on Amazon, but generally not a lot of really useful content. And David J. Williams' website sort of counters that. Really does have a lot of good content if you find yourself so interested in the work that you want to geek out on it. And you're going to hear us talk a little bit more about the website during the interview. Wanted to mention that I'm getting a lot of serious noise in here, a lot of RF interference, more than normal, and really got to do something about that. And I think when I get the hard drive replaced on the laptop and start recording into that on the battery, I think that'll alleviate a lot of that. However, I don't have the money for that right now, and I'm trying to get employed. So if you notice anything, I will do, of course, noise reduction and DC offset removal, but it may sound a little rough. So just bear with me. I can't quite get the sound I want. And clearly there are some financial reasons behind that. So anyway, I hope you guys enjoy the interview. It runs right about an hour. So I won't be talking to you on the other side. I will talk to you again when I have a regular episode, when I have time to actually sit down and do one. So until then, farewell, and, you know, the whole fedora thing and all of that, you know. So, enjoy. All right, I am joined by David Williams. He is the author of the Autumn Rain trilogy, which include the titles The Mirrored Heavens, The Burning Skies, and The Machinery of Light. Welcome, David.
Thanks a lot, Jim. Good to be here.
Well, it's good to have you. We met a couple years ago at Balticon, and we haven't had the chance yet to get you on the podcast here.
That's right, yeah. It was a bit of a one of those sort of harried convention meetings in the hallway, as I recall. I recall needing a bit of caffeine at that stage of the game. We'd both been on our feet for something like 12, 16 hours straight.
I think you had sat in the room while I interviewed Patricia Bray and Joshua Palmateer, is that right?
That's right, yeah, exactly. And it's good because all I was really capable of doing at that point was sitting and listening.
Well, I understand the feeling. I was pretty pretty exhausted at the end of that day. But you sent me The Mirrored Heavens way back then, and you signed it, you said, for the legendary Indiana Jim. So, you know, you got that sense about me at least right off the bat. I'm a legend in my own mind.
Well, like I said, I saw you up close at Balticon, and after that, there was no doubt in my mind.
Well, there remains doubt in the minds of some, I think, but...
We will convince the skeptic.
Well, that's the aim here. Let's talk about the Mirrored Heavens real quick, at least, just because that's my launching point for this.
Sure.
You've got a writing style that is very fast-paced. You've got crisp, punchy dialogue, kind of brief descriptions, and even the format is different. You don't have any chapter breaks. You only have scene breaks, and then you have, of course, three different sections to the book. What was the inspiration behind this kind of style?
You know, it's interesting. I honestly, in some ways, didn't realize how offbeat some of it was until the editor said, "So there are no chapters, huh?" And I said, there are. Who needs chapters? It's, you know, it's the 21st century. People want it in bite-sized chunks was my rationale. Actually, I'm kind of giving myself too much credit there because there really, honestly, wasn't a huge amount of rationale. I wanted three different threads. I mean, I knew that I, at least for the first book, I would have you be cutting in and out of three different threads. And, I mean, I could have gone for the paragraph-length chapters that we sometimes see out there. But in the end, I just kind of thought, you know, there's something about writing the whole thing almost in that kind of real-time narrative. You know, it's one of the reasons it's in present tense because...
Right.
I think in some ways, you know, past tense kind of privileges things. You know things are going to work out somehow because there's a relative point where you're looking at the whole thing from. And I want to really sort of immerse people in and really kind of drop them in the action. I have to say, though, that the best idea in formatting in there is one I can't really take credit for because the symbols that you'll see at the beginning of each section, each of which denotes a character point of view, that was my editor's idea, my original editor, Juliet Ullman, who came up with that idea to help sort of ground people in the text.
Well, that's a really helpful thing, too, because as soon as I see that symbol, I know whose perspective we're going into, and you don't have to reestablish who you're talking about.
Yeah, and it was a vital, I think, part of the book in many ways, with these different points of view, because this is... You know, in very many ways, this is it's an espionage novel translated into a science fiction context. And so the question of identity is absolutely critical. The question of who knows what, the question of memory, you're dealing with characters whose memories are suspect thanks to their spy master handlers.
Mm-hmm.
And so no one character has all the information about, you know, once... Early in the book, you have, you know, this terrorist group, Autumn Rain, that is blowing up the world's space elevator and promising further strikes. No one character has all the information on what's really going on here. I mean, I'm really a big believer in off-screen space. And having those different points of view, you can start to perhaps piece it all together.
Was that kind of did you get inspiration for that kind of thing from mystery novels or crime novels as far as piecing information together?
Well, I'm a big fan of a lot of the Cold War thrillers, you know, like Len Dayton or John le Carré in particular.
Mm.
And I think that's where I was getting a lot of my inspiration. Actually, it was funny because once I'd, when Jenny Rappaport, my agent, had signed me, she described the books as being very much like, her words were, John le Carré on sci-fi crack. I certainly wouldn't be the one to go about comparing myself to the great Le Carré, but I am looking for sci-fi crack. I've yet to find it, but I'll be posted if I do.
Wonder what they would charge for that sort of thing.
I always sort of thought of it more as like the Cuban Missile Crisis on acid, but you know, the idea being you're sort of taking these events, you're taking these geopolitical narratives, and then you're feeding them through a futuristic strain of, well, where could all this be in 100 years?
Mm-hmm. When you wrote this in present tense, have you always written in present tense, or was it just part of this idea here?
Well, these are the only fiction narratives I've ever actually written, to be honest with you. So I think there's I don't really have much to compare it to, per se. I mean, the only other publishing experience I have is... the video game Homeworld, which I have story concept on at the end of the 90s. But there's an interesting quote, actually. I have a book right here, a guy, Greg Denning, who's a scholar at the University of Melbourne. His quote, I'll just put it in here right now to the record, is, So try writing what you've written in the past tense, in the present tense, and you'll see what I mean. What we have to do is give back to the past we are writing about its own present tense. We give back to the past its own possibilities, its own ambiguities, its own incapacity to see the consequences of its action. It's only then that we represent what actually happened. And I think there's something important about that, you know, that I mean, I'm fascinated by history. History obsesses me, and in many ways I saw science fiction as future history. And, you know, when you look at history in retrospect, it's tinged with this aura of inevitability about what direction everything was going to go. Mm-hmm. And if you can really sort of drop everything right into that present tense, then you're at one with the contingency of the characters. Now, there's stylistic issues you've got to be careful of, right? I mean, you can then really overuse the word now, and there are certain turns of phrase which, if you're not careful, you're going to end up falling into. I suspect the other thing that was going on here is that these books never, you know, unlike a lot of writers, I didn't go through critique groups back in the early stages, and I suspect if I'd done that, they would have beaten that out of me pretty quickly and also put some chapters in. So,
yeah.
So far as those books are idiosyncratic, I'm kind of glad they are.
Have you ever read any other books that didn't have the chapter conventions in there?
You know, none are coming to mind off the top of my head, but I dare say they are out there. I mean, in terms of and it's not as experimental as it makes it sound. Because to my mind, all these points of view in some ways were just simply very short chapters. You know, that you're just kind of cutting back and forth amidst all these sorts of narratives. The tense issue is interesting. I mean, if you look at a guy like Peter Watts' first novel in Starfish, he has present tense when you're below the surface of the sea. It's a book about, you know, underwater sci-fi, and past tense when you're above the surface of the sea. And I think it's what struck me, one of the reasons I got interested in that, is that if you do present tense correctly, you can kind of get the best of both worlds, because you convey this kind of dreamlike intensity and at the same time a certain immediacy. Mm-hmm. And that's in some ways what I was going for there.
Yeah, immediacy was definitely the word that came to mind for me. But the good thing about it is I didn't really realize it was in present tense until all of a sudden that he says, and it just hit me all of a sudden, I've been reading this book and it's present tense, but you don't really notice it. You know, it's very subtle. And you said something that triggered that idea was when you said that, you know, you don't want to overuse the word now. You know, you don't necessarily present it in an overt way. It's just kind of, you let the reader experience it, and it has a very natural flow.
Well, if you look at the book is, of course, divided into sections, the four different sections there, and you know, the first section of the first book called Immersion, that concept of immersion was what I was going for there, is that you're kind of dropped into that style, but you're also dropped into that world. You're dropped into the early 22nd century, and it's both startlingly similar to our own and yet alarmingly different in a number of different ways. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to sort of get that feeling of you're just suddenly plunged into that, and you're at one with those characters, and this whole new world unfolds at that point.
What was the catalyst for you that inspired this world, this setting?
There are two answers to that. One is simply that I had a premature midlife crisis back in the late 90s and started to wonder exactly what I'd be doing with the rest of my life, and realized if I was ever going to start writing, it was kind of now or never. So I actually started the books in 2000, 2001. And then there were sort of two different strands on top of that. One was just this feeling that there was an aspect of the future that science fiction writers weren't grappling with aggressively, which was a certain aspect of the near future. I'd never really bought into the whole cyberpunk notion that the nation states are going to wither away and we're going to be dealing with corporations instead. Mm-hmm. If anything, I see nation states getting stronger and bigger and uglier, perhaps.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's particularly the case when you apply it to the World Wide Web. So the world of Autumn Rain, obviously, is a world with a second Cold War. And it's also a world where space and cyberspace have both been weaponized. I mean, the immediate impetus really was that question. It was seeing the U.S. military knowing that the future of warfare lies in space and trying to say, well, what does that really look like, right? It's not going to look like Star Wars with dogfights and the equivalent of, you know, World War One flying aces in space. Mm-hmm. It's going to look like something different. You know, space is already militarized, right? Every time a American GI uses GPS, that's the militarization of space. And then what happens when the enemy tries to deny you access to space? What would that actually look like? You know, it's a little like World War One in the terms of, you know, first you had aircraft flying over the different trenches and looking down on, you know, doing recon, and then eventually the aircraft started to take pot shots at one another. That's the same kind of dynamic that's going to occur across the next century, and the U.S. military is under no illusions as to that's the way it's going to go. That's likely to occur, I think, in tandem with the weaponization of cyberspace as well. Now, whether or not it would go to the point in which it happens in the books, where you literally have the worldwide net fragmented along geopolitical lines, you know, there's an Eastern net and there's a Western net. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's going to go that far, but you're certainly, with all the talk about cybersecurity and cyber terrorism, seeing an increased focus on that.
Yeah.
And so those are sort of the twin pillars, I think, of what I wanted to build that world of the early 2110. It was to take that as the backdrop, and in the foredrop have a question of espionage and memory wipes and characters who are caught up in this world. They're all American agents serving the United States in the early 22nd century, and they have to navigate through this mess.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that you notice nowadays, and it immediately made me think of China, the way they kind of cut off some of these IP addresses and sort of try to insulate, you know, their people.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, because it's you know, the World Wide Web is very much in the Wild West stage right now. I mean, it is yet to be seen what phase it's going to evolve into. And, you know, if you believe some out there, you know, there's very much this hope that it'll ultimately set us all free, that it'll increase, and I think it's, you know, certainly increased personal liberty in various areas, and it has a great deal of potential in that area. But it's at a crossroads, and it could go either way, because at the end of the day, the World Wide Web is dependent on physical assets. If you control the satellites, if you control the phone companies, if you control the power lines, you can control the net. And so any notion that it's automatically going to be the great equalizer, I think is something that has to be seen as suspect. And so in some ways, you can sort of see what I'm trying to do with these books as a warning about the direction that this could actually go.
Right.
All the world governments by early 2110 in my book are pretty much authoritarian. I mean, America's kind of made that transition from a republic to an empire and occupies large chunks of South America in large part to get at the equatorial launch real estate, because if you launch spaceships from the equator, it's cheaper. And the Eastern nations have done the same with Africa. So it's certainly a warning about direction things could go. And, you know, it's in some ways, I think, saying we have to be very careful not to make autumn. I mean, that was, again, why I always saw the original cyberpunk claim of the state's going to wither away as naive as in some ways. I mean, it was visionary when it came out, no question. But to me, cyberpunk is about alienation. And I see no reason why servants of the state can't be any less alienated than the street samurai and hackers presented in Old Guard cyberpunk.
You mentioned something else interesting when you were talking about GPS and controlling the satellites, and then you compared it to World War II. You know, in warfare, you want to control your enemy's supply lines, or you want to destroy their supply lines, but then there's this information supply line. And so, you know, you see the weaponization of space as a very real future.
Yeah, because what we're the other sort of trend to sort of layer on top of this is you know, what I might call the maturity of directed energy weapons. I mean, you know, lasers, particle beams, masers, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly that maturity has been greatly exaggerated. I mean, when Ray came up with his Star Wars in the 80s, that was more intended to kind of scare the Soviets to the bargaining table than it was to suggest any real immediate aspirations for building that kind of technology. But if you, it's not a question of if, it's more just simply a question of when. That if you fast forward across enough decades, you will see this weaponization of space and cyberspace go hand in hand with the maturity of directed energy weapons.
Mm-hmm.
So once speed of light weaponry comes into its own, then you will see the kind of industrial strength missile shields that Reagan waxed so poetically about in rhetoric. And that's true regardless of politically how you end up feeling about that.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is that the era of mutually assured destruction gets swept away. It's a whole new, because you can hit any one missile is highly unlikely to get through, because you'll take it out with lasers, with speed of light weaponry. And that has profound implications for the way in which warfare is likely to be waged. I mean, it's interesting because this was sort of the original thread which I was pulling on that became the books. I mean, ultimately, it kind of perhaps became much more than that, in that I've actually written an essay on that that's on my website on autumnrain2110.com and presented it at the, I live in D.C., I've been fortunate enough to present it at the Library of Congress and also the National Academy of Sciences. But again, it was all in some ways backdrop to this story of the agents who have to sort of navigate through this. But obviously, as a sci-fi writer, you get very into world building, and that's what I was trying to do here.
Talk a little bit about the way maybe September 11th and the War on Terror relates to this, because you said you started writing this back in 2000 and 2001. Did September 11th change the way you approached the subject matter?
It's a great question, Jim, and it probably intensified the approach I took to the subject matter, in that a year before 9/11, I was wanting to write a book that began with a massive act of terrorism. I mean, it was in this case being that these two superpowers, the Eastern and Western superpowers, United States and Eurasian coalition, after decades of an arms race, have come to their senses. They've recognized that this is going to herald economic and certainly environmental catastrophe for the planet if they keep this up. And so there's detente between the two of them. And to try and cement that detente, they've built a space elevator. It's not one of the geo beanstalks. It doesn't stick right out of the equator. Instead, it's about 4,000 kilometers long, and it orbits the Earth 10 times a day. And I stole it straight out of NASA briefing papers, because I thought, a geo elevator is probably going to be a little bit of a stretch in the next 100 years, but a LEO elevator may be. And this gets blown up by Autumn Rain, who is a new player in town. It's totally unclear who they are, whether they're a pawn of East or West or a whole new player or a front for somebody else. And obviously at that point, they... manhunt goes on across the Earth-Moon system for them. All the agents are swept into the field, and both East and West suspect the other, because no one knows who is actually running Autumn Rain. That much I came up with before 9/11, and 9/11, obviously, that was a dynamic that both intensified it and also for a while made me think that the book was going to be unpublishable, because for the few years after 9/11, you couldn't even use the word terrorist in a manuscript. It became a dirty word. I had to call them insurgents and that sort of thing. But living in Washington, D.C. across that time, watching Dick Cheney's motorcade whip by my office every day, and you could set your clock to it practically, was a really interesting environment to write that book, because D.C. is not what I'd call a huge science fiction town. It's not like New York. It's not like Seattle. In many ways, I was working in comparative isolation, and I realized that in some ways the books were a study of the national security state under pressure. I mean, what does it do to a nation when you've had that first strike and you've got the perpetual acid of alert, seeping through you, this sort of corrosion of perpetual alert, waiting for that second strike?
Mm-hmm.
In D.C., we very much felt under the crosshairs, and the idea of having to hold that, having to be in that kind of society across a period of decades, struck me as, what would that do to the men and women in that society? What kind of measures would we have to start taking on a day-to-day basis you know, where air travel is going is, I think, just the start of this. So 9/11 absolutely, it was sort of a, there were those two paradigms of warfare, right, both nation on nation and weaponization of space, but also this notion of, you know, what could a single terrorist group do, that I was really wrestling with here.
It's very intriguing to me, because I sit there and think through some of this stuff. It's, your descriptions aren't very long, obviously, so the imagination has to fill in a lot of gaps. What is the science behind the space elevator in the Mirrored Heavens?
Yeah, and it's interesting, because it's one of the things I did is, you know, put on my website a lot of the background information, both geopolitical and also technology-wise. But you're right, Jim. I mean, I am a big fan of shorthanding tech descriptions, you know, in some ways, because I don't want to drag the reader through it, and because, honestly, in a lot of science fiction I read, I found those were the parts I skipped. You know, I got more into the machinations, more into the characters, more into what happens, rather than needing to know, you know, I don't know how long a particular thing is. And also in some ways, because I wanted this tech to kind of, you know, I kind of like the Frank Herbert approach, where he doesn't tell you, you know, he never tells you what type of las burner it is. You never know it's a Mitsubishi las burner or whatever. He just simply says it's a las burner. And it's almost at that point, the abbreviation of description allows those things, in Herbert at least, to take on an archetypal form.
Uh-huh.
And that in some ways was what I was going for. I mean, to answer your specific question, like I said, I was fascinated by space elevators, you know, grew up reading Clark and Fountains of Paradise and all that. And I wanted something, though, that no one had actually seen. And, you know, if you look at Wikipedia, there's a lot of, Wikipedia wasn't around then, but there's a lot of space elevators in science fiction, and there aren't so many LEO space elevators, low orbit space elevators. And I wanted it to be, you know, this thing that, you know, you could literally, you know, see out the window, sweeping past you. And obviously when the initial action begins, you've got characters in the city in South America, you know, who are watching this elevator in the sky, and you've also got characters who are in spaceships outside of the elevator, you know, watching as it gets hijacked by Autumn Rain. And the idea also is it was meant to be sort of part of a larger statement about, you know, this is a world that is trying to turn the corner, that oil has peaked, and we're trying to shift Earth's industrial focus into space, and we're trying to get away from chemical rockets per se and trying to use, you know, tethers and elevators and that sort of thing. But it's messy and it doesn't come easy. And of course, the other problem is these structures are all intensely vulnerable. I mean, arguably the only thing cooler than a 4,000 kilometer long space elevator, which you can actually reach, you don't need orbital speed to reach it. You just need suborbital speed if you can get to the lowest point on it as it dips down into the atmosphere. Huge structure, and arguably the only thing cooler than that is watching it get blown up. So that's what I was doing across the first 50 pages of Mirrored Heavens. And obviously that's on the back of the book, so I'm not really giving anything away there.
Right. No spoiler alerts.
Exactly.
You mentioned, what was it, John le Carré, is that right?
Le Carré, yeah, exactly.
What other writers inspired you or currently inspire you in your writing besides him, or include him? And what is it about them that does that for you?
I mean, I think there were sort of two or three strands of that. You know, it was certainly, I grew up on a lot of the traditional science fiction, you know, and then, you know, more recently people, you know, like Reynolds and Strauss and Watts and those guys, you know, who have such a great way of bringing such an immediacy and an intensity to their writing. Some of it was, you know, but a lot of it was outside the SF field. You know, Le Carré and Dayton obviously being, you know, classic examples, you know, that kind of espionage. And then frankly, a lot of it was actually just raw history, which, you know, again, is something that's always been a huge interest of mine, you know, reading people like Gibbon or Thucydides or that sort of thing. And there's a lot of the Roman Empire in these books. You know, the president's own personal security force are called Praetorians, which is a not-so-subtle reference to, you know, the Roman imperial system. And that in some ways was what I was trying to do, was to try and extrapolate. I mean, it's you know, I wouldn't sort of confuse prophecy with prognostication, right? In that, you know, when you write a book like that, you're not claiming this is exactly how it's going to go. You're saying this is one scenario amidst many that it might play out as. Along with also, there was sort of thinking about, you know, I mean, I grew up in the 70s when it looked like we were going to be on Mars by the year 2000, and obviously that didn't quite happen. Mm-hmm. And it's not a case of the future having failed us. It's a case of, you know, where's my jetpack and all that. It's a case of the future being more complicated than, you know, we thought it was, and evolving in unexpected directions. And obviously the internet has gone far beyond our wildest dreams, whereas space travel in many ways has kind of languished. And I was trying to think, you know, that's all very well, but if you give it a century, where could all this go? So space elevators is one thing I was looking at. Obviously in book two, in the burning skies, the action shifts to a neutral point, the L3 point, the Lagrangian point, where the neutral Europeans have built an O'Neill cylinder. Again, that was another piece of technology which I was eager to get into in there, something that was a staple of sci-fi in the 70s and maybe in the early 80s, and not so much now. So a lot of that research was being drawn into and encompasses, you know, my reading fair.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's an element of idealism wherein, you know, we've always been taught that in the future, education will be better, people will be smarter, you know, the human species will evolve out of this constant strife, and the future will be this bright, happy place where everyone contributes to the benefit of humanity. But to me,
taking energy pills and you know, all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, and when you look at history, like, you know, like you say, you can look back at history and see the inevitable outcome. The majority of human technological advancement, it seems to me, has been surrounding the issue of warfare. You know, other than certain, you know, medical advancements, a lot of our technology comes from the military trying to find its own advancements, including things like GPS.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because you could sort of claim in some ways that's, you know, part and parcel of the Darwinian ethos, you know, that you have to take that kind of stuff seriously. In military, you can't afford to say, oh, well, that piece of technology is going to occur or not occur, or it couldn't possibly happen. You have to take it seriously. You can't afford to say that, because otherwise, for all you know, the other side is going to be working on it instead. So there's some of that. There's some of, I think, as you know, also on the Darwinian paradigm, I mean, we're very short term in our thinking. It's very tough for us to think beyond the next 10 minutes, you know, standing there on the African savanna in the year 1,000,000 BC, wondering if there's a leopard around the corner. I mean, your main concern is there a leopard behind that tree? It's not necessarily, gee, what thing's going to look like a year from now, because you don't know if there's a future. And that, to me, is the real hope of science fiction, that science fiction is what kind of ties all this together and gives us a framework big enough to view the future. Mm-hmm. And right now, obviously, we're not there. I mean, you know, you look at, you know, again, after the First Cold War, and why I keep saying First Cold War, because I have a Second Cold War in my books, but there's only been one Cold War, fortunately. You had a guy like Francis Fukuyama coming out and saying, history's over. It's That's the end of history. I mean, that was the big book of 91, 92 was his book on the end of history. And difficult, obviously, even at the time, to express how stupid an idea that is. And yet, if I mean, it was obvious to me as an 18-year-old uber nerd, you know, I immediately wrote out 100 different directions the future could take, because I read science fiction. It wasn't because I was smart per se. I simply was schooled in science fiction. Mm-hmm. Those kind of claims, which were made by the so-called intellectual elite of our society, would be impossible if our society had truly integrated a science fiction thinking into its mode of discourse. And so when, you know, that I think is the real price we pay for science fiction being such a marginalized literature, is that it allows people to get away with that kind of inanity that does us a huge, huge disservice, because, you know, obviously 20 years later, 9/11 having occurred and everything else, you know, it was the end of an era, all right. It certainly wasn't the end of history. We've got a lot more history to put up with.
Right. Let's kind of take a turn away from sort of the philosophy of this particular subject, and let's get sort of into the mechanics of writing, because I've got a lot of listeners and friends, and we're all kind of aspiring writers, and we're all trying to get into the game. You know, we're all aspiring to be published.
Yeah, it's filling up the well.
Right. Kind of talk about the road that you took to publication, because you said earlier that this is kind of the first real prose narrative that you've written. How did you get to publication on basically your first major effort?
Some of it, again, was, you know, as I said, by and large, had a corporate job across the 90s and the last decade, but I was doing a little bit of moonlighting out in Vancouver for some folks called Relic Entertainment. They're the ones who did the Homeworld games, which made a big splash when they first came out. And I ended up contributing story concept to the first Homeworld game and getting a contributing writer credit on the second Homeworld game. And that kind of opened my eyes to the possibilities, you know, because I was never one of those. You know, you talk to a lot of published writers out there, and I was looking at someone's bio this morning on this. It was, you know, when they won the contest in junior high for writing, that's where they sold their first story when they were 10 or whatever. And that was never me. It honestly didn't occur to me until I was 30 that someone was actually writing these books and that you could actually do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't one of those writers who wanted to be a writer forever and ever. I wanted to write history. I wanted to perhaps go into academia, but the idea of writing fiction just simply didn't occur to me until I got involved in video games, at which point I realized, hey, this was being created by somebody, and also I realized it was a lot of fun. I mean, the big revelation for me about the Homeworld games were less perhaps, you know, how to create world-beating space opera, because I think my story contributions there were nothing compared to the art and the music and the game rendering that was really making that game. But more just the idea of why is it that I was working, you know, my day job on corporate spreadsheets and profit and loss statements while my friends were drawing spaceships for a living. I mean, that made a profound impression on me.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get into writing, I think, for a lot of motives. You know, you get into it for, you know, so-called low motives of seeing your name in print and, you know, probably some narcissistic impulses in there. And you also get into it perhaps for higher motives as, you know, as the game progresses. And I realized that perhaps I had, you know, a story to tell, that there was this aspect of near future science fiction, as I said, around space and cyberspace and the question of identity that no one was really driving for, particularly once I kind of came up with we spent a lot of time talking about technology, but just to put characters in there, I mean, the two main characters here being Claire Haskell and Jason Marlowe, and they're agents for SICOM, for U.S. counterintelligence, and they haven't seen each other in 10 years, and they used to be lovers 10 years ago. So, you know, you're in a room again on the mission of your life with your old flame, and you learn about 30 minutes into that mission that someone might be messing with your memories. So did you ever really know this woman? You know, it's almost a little Eternal Sunshine of a Spotless Mind meets James Bond.
Hmm.
And once I came up with that was a huge sort of impulse in kind of propelling me forward, that was kind of the foreground, that the human hook that would sort of pull people into this story. Getting back, though, to your question of the mechanics, in many ways, I mean, if you know, what happened then is kind of typical, in that I just simply wrote for years and didn't really realize the odds against me. You know, I mean, there's a bit of a safety valve, I think, that comes in when you first start writing, in that if you really knew how bad you were, you'd quit immediately.
Yeah.
But because you're really bad, you don't realize that, and so you just kind of keep writing and keep putting stuff on paper. And honestly, it wasn't for about 4 or 5 years that the writing really started to click and really started to get tossed, and I started to realize that I wasn't just fooling myself with what I had. And I'd always sort of, I think the other thing to sort of note is that, you know, it pays to start small, but it also pays to think big, that I always envisioned this as being it's funny, The Machinery of Light, which is being released in May, that was the original story. I mean, that was going to be, and then I realized that wasn't enough, that there was a whole story before that that needed to be told about how we got to that point.
Yeah.
And that became the focus. So that when I was going out to the publishers, I mean, when you send out query letters, no one really wants to hear this is a giant series. But as soon as they're into the first book and they like the first book and they want to mm-hmm. buy the first book,
right.
then they love to hear that it's a giant series.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, and so I think that was another dynamic that's worth sort of putting in there, is that I have three books planned out, and it isn't a never-ending series. We're not talking one of these things that's just going to keep going and going and going. All questions are answered with book three. You know, but I was able to sort of deliver a narrative in the first book, in The Mirrored Heavens, that was self-contained, that answered all the questions, but also left, you know, big hooks on the table to drag people into the second book with.
Right. And I think you did a really good job with that, if I can say that.
Well, thank you. I mean, in some ways that was, you know, I didn't want it to end with one of these, you know, and, you know, they're hanging on the end of the cliff and then
yeah.
someone starts stomping on their fingers and uh-oh, and you get to find out. You know, I knew that you wanted to target it at about 100,000 words, 110,000 words. But also, I mean, you know, you've got various things in here that allow you to expand the canvas. You know, some of the book one goes down on the moon, but most of book two goes down in space. The Burning Skies takes place largely in space. And so even though I created this future world of space weaponization and the Earth-Moon system being divided between these two superpowers, you see relatively little of it until book two, at which point you can really expand the canvas. So I think that was another important step I was taking as well.
Right. Are you one of those authors who avoids reading in your genre that you're writing in?
You know, I do. Honestly, I do when I'm in production mode.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I kind of have two modes, and, you know, sometimes I'm in them both simultaneously. But when I'm writing, you know, 8 to 10 hours a day or whatever, yeah, generally I'm avoiding science fiction at that point,
mm-hmm.
partially because I'm just OD'd on it by
right.
the end of the day.
Yeah.
Partially, but also, I mean, partially because, you know, if you're just reading the science fiction everyone else is reading, you're not staying ahead of the competition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, there was a deliberate attempt there on, you know, my thinking was, by reading certain types of history that most people aren't reading, I can, however, implicitly inform the narrative with that.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if I'm just simply, you know, reading the latest, you know, Charles Stross or something like that, then I'll get pulled into his vision of, you know, the singularity or whatever he might be writing about, one given point, and perhaps get too influenced by that. So there's a little bit of the anxiety of influence going on here.
Mm-hmm.
I think, I suspect more mature writers, you know, who have been at it for more years than I have will have less anxiety about that. But that was definitely, I was definitely trying to be careful of what kind of crossed my mental screen when I was writing a lot of this stuff.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if that's common for people who write mostly science fiction, because most of my writing is fantasy. Most of it's, you know, sort of that medieval setting, that historical type thing.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I guess for science fiction authors, you're looking toward the future, and you don't want to, you know, everybody's got a vision of the past. That's easy to find everywhere, but I guess when you're reading someone with a specific vision of the future, that sort of colors your perspective a little more than, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think so, in that you could almost argue that, you know, I mean, with fantasy, you know, I mean, we don't, I think, worry as much about the metaphysics of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's sort of this, I think, you know, we have this idea perhaps that, you know, there's enough world out there in the multiverse for, you know, all these different visions to exist.
Right.
Whereas, you know, if you look at where, you know, we are right now, I mean, we're going in one of these directions. I mean, you know, one doesn't want to call oneself a futurist, but some science fiction writers out there are going to be more right than others about where all this is going.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you look at science fiction as in some ways being about the corruption of technology's promise, there are different ways in which that vision can get corrupted. Again, it's one of the reasons why we're sort of, you know, writing near future. And I think that's the other thing, is that it's easier for me to read stuff that isn't directly related to what I was. I mean, just as I found it tough to read science fiction during some of this, it was tougher to read near future science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think I had a very different vision of where all that was going. I mean, space opera, I mean, there's been such a resurgence of that, but in terms of its applicability to where we are as a species, I mean, this stuff is, you know, 10,000, 20,000 years in the future, FTL travel, that sort of thing. Those aren't necessarily the technologies that are going to bail us out of the present predicament that I was really trying to focus on.
Yeah. Do you think that we're experiencing a resurgence in the quote-unquote hard science fiction with writers like Charles Stross and some others?
Well, I think we're certainly experiencing a resurging equality. I think, you know, if you look at where the market's gone the last several years, it really is. I'm seeing no signs that it's continuing to do anything other than tip towards fantasy, in particular urban fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some of that is kind of the anxiety of the future, or maybe even the product of the recession we're in right now, is that we, you know, science fiction is no longer escapist entertainment. I mean, in fact, it's almost like, as Joyce Carol Oates once said, all writers of fiction are writing science fiction. Most of them just don't know it. I mean, here you and I are, and we haven't, you know, seen each other since Balticon, but we're talking via this arcane device that is projecting our voice across the wires. You know, we have various other mobile devices here. You know, strange objects fly in the sky overhead called aircraft. You can book seats on them. I mean, science fiction is here, and it's a reality, and you know, I think that's all the more reason why it becomes perhaps, you know, problematic in the marketplace right now.
Mm-hmm. Tell me what kind of things you're doing to help in the promotion side of things as far as your books are concerned. Because I know, obviously, you go to Balticon. That's one.
Yeah, that was one. I met you there. That was a second. I think one of the mainstay for me about promotion is the website. And that kind of, I mean, I'm like, I think a lot of writers out there, I'm a better creator than I am a promoter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you see that, right? I mean, in terms of the skill sets of writers out there, I mean,
yeah.
It's the hardest thing in the world, I think, to, you know, sit there with your computer and your cats and your vision for the future, and then ultimately it gets published and you have to go out and promote it. So for me, the online mechanisms, I mean, were always, you know, critical. I'm not as adroit by any means at online promotion as, say, you know, a John Scalzi or a Jay Lake or those guys who, you know, have the advantage they both write great fiction and they also promote it very effectively.
Mm-hmm.
But I also had a whole sort of world that was kind of left on the cutting room floor here. I mean, when I turned in Mirrored Heavens, it was 105, 110,000 words, and it was about 15,000 more words of appendices because, you know, I remember loving Dune, and of course you want to have huge appendices. And I'd written a ton of appendices. That was the first thing I ever did. I had essays on future warfare, I had timelines, I had analysis of the various types of space planes in the year 2110, I had, you know, drawings of the technology, and, you know, obviously Bantam did the only sane thing they could at that point, which was to cut it, because that would have made no sense to put in at the end there, and instead it became the material, the content for the website. So on Autumn Rain 2110, that's where I have information on the background behind all three books. You have information about the geopolitics. You have maps. You have schematics of the various countries. You have schematics of weapon systems and the hardware of the second space age. Mm-hmm. And that website's actually gotten a fair amount of press and traction out there. I also, since I have a video game past, I understood the importance of having an important visual focus. And so, you know, friends of mine who are artists were kind enough to draw out a lot of cool stuff and put it out there as well. So you'll see, you know, drawings of O'Neill cylinders and, you know, space elevators exploding and that sort of thing. That becomes, I think, the hub. I mean, everything else is beyond that, be it Twitter or Facebook or, talking to folks like yourself and having my voice appear in various places it wouldn't otherwise appear. Mm-hmm. But I think the hub is the website, because that's the kind of promoting you can do even if you're not around to do it. It sits up there, and I didn't want it to sort of be it's less about me. I mean, I think there's a paragraph on me in there, but I wanted it to be less about me and more about the world of Autumn Rain, the world of the early 22nd century.
And that's one of the things that really attracts me to your website, because you have a link to your blog and you have your upcoming events and all of that, but the fact that it is kind of an online appendix and sort of, I don't know, it's a different element. It's unusual to me. I'm not used to seeing that kind of information on an author's website.
Part of it, I think, again, was my thing of, you know, I'd already, literally the first thing I ever did when I, started writing the book was I wrote a timeline, and I, ran around to all my friends, as one does when one first starts writing, saying, hey, look at the first page of my book. And they're like, characters, draw, narrative, hello. And I was like, oh, let's go get a drink. 10 years later, I had a trilogy. That's how it works. So having that kind of background material and wanting to find a sort of place for it, I think there's also, I'd be remiss if I didn't sort of mention, RPGs as well. I mean, role-playing games, yeah. Growing up in, sure I grew up on Dungeons and Dragons and all that, but, Gamma World was the one that always fascinated me, and they had a massive timeline in there. They had incredible amounts of history, and yet at the same time, the really cool thing about no matter how much history, no matter how much art you put on a website, you're still only scratching at the surface. That was one of the coolest line to me in the first Star Wars, was the bit where he says, I fought with your father in the Clone Wars. And it's like, what the hell were the Clone Wars? And obviously, eventually we went there, and, CGI caught up with us and all that, and you had that as a separate conversation. But, so you've got a whole timeline of 100 years during which this nightmare scenario develops for American foreign policy, Eurasia gets united under a hostile power that's a peer competitor to the United States that's intent on building as many weapons as possible. And yet that's only hinted at. I mean, you could set whole stories in that backdrop, in how all that took place and how gradually the world kind of, evolved into a new order, as it were.
If anybody's wondering what that strange and odd sound was, that was a sound from David's website, which is autumnrain2110.com.
Oh, is that what you're booting up there? Yeah, it's got a little bit of static and a little bit of feedback that I sort of put in there as a sound effect, voices, disembodied voices speaking to each other across the void, as it were. And I also have a video for book 3, which I'll be putting up there shortly as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're doing a pretty good job as far as web promotion and getting your voice out there and your name out there. I want to ask you one that's sort of, you mentioned this and I took a personal interest in it earlier when you said that you had experienced an early midlife crisis. What age were you when that happened?
Let's see. Now I am 39, so I guess I was 29 at that point.
Huh.
And, so I don't know if that's early or late for an early midlife crisis, but it's never too early for any kind of neurosis as far as I'm concerned. I'd sort of reconcile myself at that point to, spending a large chunk of my time in corporate America,
mm-hmm.
and was lucky enough to be working at a company that was tolerating weird people. At the same time, though, I was sort of, when you're 14 or 15, you think life goes on forever. And, I think it's one of the interesting things about science fiction is that, and this may be why, why it isn't integrated into the mainstream, is it's not just a matter of technology. It's also a matter of we're dealing in time periods that are way after our death. I mean, we'll all be dust.
Yeah.
When even near future science fiction comes about. I remember reading a graphic novel, Signal to Noise, I want to say it was, where the guy makes the point about how we're always thinking the end of the world is right in front of us. In the year 1999, they think it's going to be in the year 1000. In the year 1995, we thought it was the year 2000. In the 80s, we thought we were going to get nuked any day. now I, you know, now the New Agers are talking about 2012, and and there's this natural human tendency, though, because, you know, the end of our world is never more than a few decades away, and it's always right around the corner by definition. It's where I think the transhumanists and the singularity proponents get it wrong, is that the goal here is not personal immortality. The real question is the longevity of our species. And science fiction, I think, puts you in that framework. It also, though, as I found, ignited a fairly powerful crisis of mortality in myself when I was thinking, gee, I'm really behind here. I mean, people, if I'm really going to get into fiction, people I know are already published, they've already written, you know, short stories, they're already world famous with novels. And none of that, I think, would have mattered if I hadn't sort of latched onto something that I was going to write on. I mean, I don't know if I would have been the one to write fantasy or write space opera, but near future science fiction was something that I thought, you know, no one's doing this, and there's something critical here that I think people might be missing. You know, it's a little like that moment in Raiders of the Lost Ark where Indiana Jones says, you know, your namesake there, you know, says, the Nazis are digging in the wrong place. And, you know, it wasn't to say everyone was digging in the wrong place per se, it was to say there was this area of the future that was not colonized, as it were, by science fiction, that wasn't, there was this gap that was falling between the techno thrillers of, say, Tom Clancy, which will go 10 to 20 years from now, but not much further, and the space opera fantasies, where the future kicks in much, much further after we've got past the singularity. And I thought, you know, I could get in there and do something with that, that untrammeled terrain.
And I think it definitely lends itself to accessibility for people in our time, and I think that's another great selling point about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there are shades of, you know, this autumn rain future that are, you know, all around us right now in terms of, you know, I mean, NASA's next steps, in terms of, you know, I mean, it's ironic with space, right, is that, you know, unfortunately, so far, the best reason we've ever come up with to get into space is that the other guy's doing it. I mean, we may be not looking at going back to the moon right now, but I guarantee you that when China gets to the moon, we're going to want to be on the moon pretty quick.
Yeah.
And that's all going to occur across the next, you know, 15 to 20 years. I mean, China has hundreds of thousands of people on its space program right now. And these guys, unlike us, did not stop believing in that future. They are absolutely fired, you know, with almost a crusading zeal, the same kind of crusading zeal we saw at NASA in the 60s to get there. When we talk about, as you say, hacks occurring, you know, the Russia attacking Georgia 2 years ago, and part of that was cyber war, where Russia shut down Georgia's servers and, you know, eliminated their web propensity or their web capability. And also just sort of this ongoing tension between, you know, security and civil liberties, which we clearly see in the wake of 9/11, that those are all aspects of where I was trying to go with the Autumn Rain trilogy.
After the Autumn Rain trilogy, what's next for you?
Knew you were going to ask me that, Jim. it's a great question. I mean, I don't yet know, to be honest. I mean, I'm not under contract for additional novels. I'm trying to figure out what I want to do in that regard. I don't intend, I think, to write more near future science fiction. I mean, the one thing I can guarantee you is that the machinery of light ends. Like, it's not a fake setup for, you know, a fourth book. It's not a stealthy kind of, and now there'll be several more books going on here. I don't rule out returning to this universe, but probably more in terms of stuff that happens before Autumn Rain, before the year 2110. I'm actually looking at potentially doing a graphic novel set in that world. And so I think that's sort of the other question is, do I want to continue with novels, or would I rather, you know, go back into video games? I've written a couple non-related screenplays, some of them science, one of them science fiction, one of them not, that I'm looking to pitch. So in some ways, you know, this is at once both the best and the worst time to ask that question, because I'm at a crossroads here. I mean, you know, it's funny because people have only heard about the Autumn Rain trilogy for the last 24 months. The first one got released in May of 2008, but for me, this has been my life.
Yeah.
The better part of this decade, that's all I've thought about. And so, you know, right now I'm kind of taking a break. I mean, these are characters that in the back of my head, even though getting this published was always the ultimate ambition, in the back of my head, I kind of wondered if I ever would. Mm-hmm. And now I'm in an even more bittersweet position, which is having to say goodbye to these characters.
Yeah.
So that leave-taking will probably go on for, you know, it is a bittersweet moment. That'll probably go on for the next few months while I try and figure out exactly what project I want to tackle next.
Do you still have the day job?
You know, I don't, actually. I was fortunate enough to retire, as it were, from the corporate world when I was a couple of years ago. The firm that's, you know, pure luck, really. The firm I was at did very well on Wall Street. And, you know, that, I think, gave me also the freedom to start to think, you know, well, how am I going to sort of fill up, you know, the rest of my days, the rest of my life? It was always the goal to escape the corporate day job. I just didn't really realize that the economics of publishing were not such that would truly enable me to do that. I was able to walk away anyway, you know, more because of timing and luck than any sort of real skill on my part. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, that luck is part and parcel with getting the thing published as well, is that, you know, it's very much a question of timing. It's very much a question, you said earlier, you know, in terms of talking about how this stuff gets published. I've written an essay I put on my website about how I got published specifically. The best advice I can give people is you've got to really kind of get in there and get face-to-face contact going on with these agents and with these editors. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wasn't someone who had a ton of connections in the field, but I can certainly tell you that the only agent who saw any of my manuscript material was the agent I happened to run into at WorldCom, and that all the I think I did some pretty good query letters, but they all just got shot down out of hand. Mm-hmm. And so unless you have a reputation in the space to begin with short stories or that sort of thing, it's very, very difficult. I mean, the publisher's slush file has been replaced by the agent's slush file, and it's a pretty tight field right now. All the more so, I think, given you know, what's happening in the publishing industry as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Well, just in case this interview hasn't been enough for my listeners, I want to read a couple of these poll quotes real briefly. One, Stephen Baxter, author of the Manifold series, says this is Tom Clancy interfacing Bruce Sterling. Lee Modisett says, an action-jammed and audacious look at a terrifyingly plausible future. Highly recommended. But this is my favorite one. From Peter Watts, author of Blindsight. Explodes out the gate like a sonic boom and never stops. Adrenaline bleeds from Williams' fingers with every word he hammers into the keyboard. The razors of the mirrored heavens would eat cyberpunk's old guard hackers and cowboys as a light snack.
Yeah, it sounds, adrenaline bleeding sounds painful though, doesn't it? You know, I mean, Peter's a pretty intense guy, and that was a pretty intense blurb. Not that I have any complaints whatsoever, but yeah, and you're also getting obviously into the terminology here, right? That the you know, the guys who kick in doors and wear powered armor in my books are mechs, short for mechanics. They're not cyborgs. They're assassins. Whereas the razors are the actual hackers, and they partner with one another to get the dirty jobs done.
Right. It's sort of like a cyberpunk meets small scale Robotech.
Yeah, I mean, there's a little bit of kind of, you know, the cyberpunk meets Iron Man going on there, right?
And that,
you know, and again, this is sort of what I was trying to get at with, you know, with cyberpunk is, you know, it's not just occurring all in your heads or all on computers. It's you're sitting somewhere while this is going on. And you know, I mean, William Gibson does this incredibly well in The End of Neuromancer with the Stray Light run, where you basically have the equivalent of, you know, solos or mechs and partnering with hackers to get things done. This obviously was sort of, you know, bringing a different kind of context to that kind of concept.
Mm-hmm. Well, listen, David, this interview has been a whole lot of fun.
And absolutely.
The website is, again, autumnrain2110.com. It is the Autumn Rain Trilogy. And again, thank you so much for appearing on my show.
Jim, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.